You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Well, it's kind of extraordinary. We have the king of the podcasters who can't get through a paragraph, and then we have the man who doesn't podcast and he made not a single mistake, and he's the fastest reader I've ever encountered. And so we've had blood and fire, and there's a lot of things we want to talk about, but we're all doing this together, so I'm just kind of want to kick it off. But I want to ask a question. You talked about that the fire was no longer a code, it was a language. How do you distinguish that? What's that?
Well, the way in which languages are structured are much more contextualized, and they don't break down as simply as the way codes are structured. Codes, if you look at most codes, most traditional ciphers are either transposition ciphers or substitution ciphers. Transposition ciphers basically just take all the same letters. They don't change them, they just change the position. Substitution ciphers don't change any positions, but they change the actual letters that are in there. And for me, it's sort of a wonderful, it intrigues me, that sort of duality in terms of code intrigues me in regard to superposed states that exist simultaneously and both kind of describe the same thing. I'm thinking here specifically of the way in which quantum theory and relativity have never yet been meshed into one big happy family. And I think that there's something deep-seated in the way information works in the world that requires that sort of duality. And that's what I was playing with. Language is a little bit more challenging because code, you can do this one thing or another. Language is much less readily definable. Let me think about what I'm trying to say. The difference between code and language. Language is almost like, you know, it's very conscious, code is very conscious, very deterministic. There are elements in language that just don't work consciously, that they are, that they seem to have a sort of, not randomness, but a sort of indeterminacy that you can't pin down that readily. And I think of the idea here, when I'm talking to students, I'm always trying to explain the idea. If you look at literary theory, they revolt against the idea that an author could write something and not know exactly what he or she meant, okay, fully know what he or she meant. And I try to explain to them that, well, if it comes out of the psyche has both unconscious and conscious parts. So naturally there are things I'm not going to be aware of that, you know, all of us are not going to be aware of. Language has more of that. Code is much more directly, it's much more, as it were, conscious, much more definable. Language isn't. Language has a lot of this weird crap in it floating around that I think is unconscious, and that I'm fascinated. I love, and I have almost as bad an obsession as the female character in the story. They're never named, by the way, really. You never get their names. But she has an obsession with a couple of figures of speech that my wife says are my particular hobby horses, chiasmus and anti-metaboly. And I think that those are fascinating because you can take most phrases that have an of in them in English and reverse them and get something that really undercuts. It's sort of like a return of the repressed in language. Okay. For instance, there's a title of a book by Harold Bloom about poetry called The Anxiety of Influence. Okay, I always like to spin that around, think of the influence of anxiety. All right, The Anxiety of Influence is particularly resonant with me now because I like to spin off these weird ideas in my head. It probably would be treatable medically. But when I get new phrases that pop into my head, like there's one that popped into my head last night, planetary user fee for the human species, okay? That's what we need. Take care of greeting and breeding, planetary user fee. So I went to Google, which is the desktop oracle we all bow, type in that phrase to see if anybody else had used it yet. All right? So I do that. And it's always nice to know that someone hasn't, but it's disturbing to think when I have just come up with something new, full-blown from the head of Zeus, and see that, oh, yeah, there's 522,000 references to that phrase. Okay. There's one from the book of that Daniel Quinn novel, Story of B, called the phrase I thought was so wonderful that I thought I'd invented was pleasuring ourselves to death. All right. And then I went and Googled it, and oh boy, there's a bunch of them from Story of B. And I, shit. Okay. So I see that all the time. And I don't know how I got there, but you led me down this path, Bissen. All right. So there you go. But there's that level of indeterminacy in language I find fascinating. So there you go.
All right. Well, let me ask, I had a question for Scott also, which is, when you go from an oral presentation to print, and then you, what did that mean to you as a writer? I mean, you started as a writer, am I right?
Right.
Do you feel like it changed the process on the next books? Does it influence the way you write? How do you?
Well, the biggest thing is that I write the books and complete the books, then I podcast the books. When I podcast, I tend to do some on-the-fly editing, like losing the attribution. I don't need to describe the main character's attitude if I can convey that as a voice actor. So it goes from writing to the audio, and then as I'm reading it out loud, I hear where I've done a horrible job as a writer. I'm like, oh, that just sounds awful, and I'm able to go back and edit on the fly. And then as far as the projects that have come that I've written after these initial books, right, it's really been more of a cinematic storytelling approach. There's too long of a section where nothing happens here. I need to rearrange the story so that things are happening. They're going to keep the listener's interest. So it has really changed the way I write the books, definitely.
Do you edit after a podcast where you go back to the book before it goes into print?
Oh, totally, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And usually a lot of that is a lot of factual errors pointed out, particularly from any listener who's in the military. I got a lot of listeners who have military experience, a lot of very, you know, PhD candidates or PhDs who will, you know, email me back, go, that's a nice story, but there's all of this. These things are all wrong. And I'm able to go back and then pimp those people out as sources and go, okay, well, if I did this, this, and this, and the podcast version of Infected was really cool, and it was a lot of fun. The print version of Infected that's coming out April 1st is just on a completely different level as a book, thanks to a lot of the feedback I get from the audience.
So you podcast betas.
I didn't know I was.
You're beta testing.
I didn't know I was. I thought, like, Infected, that's probably the 17th draft of that book, and I thought it was done cold stone. But I just got so much feedback and saw so many things and read it out loud. So yeah, apparently everything I do is beta, and I'll never have the full release version.
Yeah, well, maybe we're all beta. Maybe
that's it. That's hoping about. For a better version. You know, it's interesting you mentioned the difference in oral and aural presentation. James Joyce, as he got older, became more and more blind, and he became more and more obsessed with the way things sounded in his head. The poet John Milton was blind by the time he wrote Paradise Lost. He actually dictated it to his daughters. And when people wouldn't come to take notes from him and take his dictation, he would get really cranky and say, I want to be milked, was the actual phrase he used, as if it was just full of this stuff that had to be brought out. And it's very intriguing, and to think that that was all done through what he heard in his head, which is neat. And it's a very different approach to the writing process. In Shakespeare's time, people didn't say, I'm going to go see a play. They said, I'm going to go hear a play. It was much less a visual medium, much more something you went to hear, closer in some ways to a radio play.
Huh,
there you go.
That's interesting. Do you think we're coming back to that?
I mean,
you were saying you think that podcasts are like the new form of literature, right?
Yeah, I guess I should the microphone and talk about that. Are we on?
Yeah.
You can hear me now. I think podcasting is...
Introduce yourself.
Hi, everybody. My name is Evo Terra. I'm a science fiction podcast from a long time, and I also am the co-founder of a site called PodioBooks.com, which has all of Scott's work and about 130 other people's who are doing this kind of work on there. Terry, as you mentioned, yeah, I do think that podcasting is changing the way that literature is done, especially for the new author, for the mid-list author, and also for the the existing successful author who's trying to break out into new areas. But it's not like it's a unique concept. I think of Kevin J. Anderson, for example, much to what Howard was talking about here, where
he was just here last month.
He reads everything into a microphone. That's his writing. He doesn't write on paper. He doesn't do a lot of keyboard work. He goes and takes a walk out in the woods and writes his book by his micro recorder, and then has his assistant transcribe it and then go through new editing. So yes, I think podcasting is changing literature, but I don't think it's just podcasting. I think literature is underchanging because of technology.
Interesting. I don't know. What do you got to say? I mean, I understand that. I deeply disapprove of that.
I think a story is a story is a story. And it just depends on how you tell it. People have any number of ways with which to craft a story, to get all of their thoughts in order, with which to link up various plot points. If that happens to be recording it on a recorder or podcasting a beta version to see what floats in market testing or doing a traditional outline with note cards, I don't see it changing. I really don't see it changing all that much. I mean, it's still, if it's a good story, people listen to it, great. What is changing is removing a lot of the gatekeepers that are going to prevent a story that may be non-traditional, cross-genre, that won't fit on a specific shelf, that doesn't come across as, ooh, it's a Western, I know people will buy this, being able to take that work, put it right out into the marketplace, and then if the audience, it resonates with the audience and you get a big following, that's good writing, because if there's, you know, 50,000 people listening to it, quote unquote, that's good writing. So that part is changing, but it's not, I don't see it changing literature.
Well,
I deeply disapprove of that too. But.
Well, I gained some unintended notoriety by using the term web scabs once upon a time.
That was you?
That was me. And that was an unnecessary incendiary comment. But my objection, I think it's wonderful that writers are now using alternative means to get themselves discovered. John Scalzi, for instance, was basically discovered through an online novel posted for free. And there are a number of folks who are advancing their careers that way, and that's fine. But I think what the potential problem with that is harms of aggregation. That you end up with, it's a great thing for a few authors, but in the long run, what you may end up with out there is a vast digital slush pile, which will be then avoided by the editors. So the gatekeepers are going to be there, agents, etc. And the other issues that might come forward with that is, yeah, it might help people in the short term, but I think the other harm of aggregation potentially is if there's so much free stuff out there, if you can get the cow for free, why buy the milk? And I think that in the long run, this will be self-limiting. Digital slush piles are going to be self-limiting. A mass of novels written by 15-year-olds, again, will be self-limiting. But in the meantime, my concern, since I was CEFWA president for two terms and was not crucified, my concern is that in the long term it may be self-limiting, but in the self-term I think it may be self-destructive to authors' advances. I don't mean individual authors. I mean authors as a whole. Now, this didn't get talked about much in SFWA because we are an author's rights organization. But I think that there are also author responsibilities. And one of an author's responsibilities is not to shaft other authors, but to make common cause with them. And so that was my objection to it. For those who are benefiting from it, fine. Okay, great. But I'm just asking people to think a little bit more long term and what the potential impacts of this might be. I mean, to lament the state of science fiction, as Terry said at the beginning, in my genre, which is hard SF, if you go into a bookstore, you'll see that the shelf of hard SF is shrinking. Now, why is that happening? People will give you a lot of different reasons for it. They'll say, oh, it's an issue of declining scientific literacy. That may be part of it. Or they'll say that a lot of the folks, our traditional market, our traditional gateway drug, as it were, 12 to 25-year-old males for the traditional early audience. A lot of those folks went to massive multiplayer games, things like Halo, Halo 2, Halo 3, and they didn't come back, all right? I don't think that's good for our genre. Now, that may mean that some of us will still keep doing this as a niche, which is sad to see, but my point is I'd put it this way. My father once said to me, and my father was a quirky guy, he once said to me that, you know, Howard, you can make a lot of money in the short term or a lot of sense in the long run. What eventually happened to him on his deathbed, my mother said, your father never made much money, but that never much bothered him. And I come from this nasty old school that says being a prophet is more important than making a profit. So I still, in my fiction, try to present things that are not only entertaining, but also annoying. All right. Dante, in talking about the Dolce Stil Nuovo, the sweet new style, of which his Divine Comedy was part of that, he said that poetry should be utile et dolce, useful and sweet. The sweet is the entertaining part. The useful is that it should do some genuine work in the world. Now, that won't make you popular. I was talking to my students today about, one of my students is a huge Disney fan, huge Disney fan. And one of the texts we were reading was the original Hans Christian Andersen version of The Little Mermaid, which is very different from the Disney version. She was very upset about that difference. And I said, well, you know, she said the Disney version is so much better. I said, well, you know, you could argue that the Disney version is in some ways more escapist. So I had to define escapism a little bit. And I think to some degree, yeah, we all, if we're thinking all the time, we deserve a little escape. Escapism is a good thing. But I think in our world, we've got so much escapism all around us that it might be good to take a break and think. Okay, and that doesn't make my students happy, and it doesn't make my readers happy, but that's too bad.
Well, if I could talk about a couple of those points. I think that regarding, I don't really see this being a problem for advances in the long run, because what we're able to establish with this podcasting and the PDFs and the Cory Doctorows of the world and John Scalzi of the world giving their content away is we're able to provide market testing for a market that is notoriously difficult to produce a profitable book. The vast majority of books that are published in the publishing industry don't make any money back for the publisher, and that's 90% of them, and they're hoping for that 5 to 10% that give the big return in order to keep everybody with a job. And a lot of what I'm doing and Evo's doing is we're putting books out there, we're getting a lot of free market testing for the publishers who are able to look at this and go, I can see that there's momentum and energy around this author. I better give this author a higher advance to get them signed. So I might be missing something there, but in the long term, I see this being more beneficial to the authors for better contracts, better advances, because now you've got publishers fighting for a proven commodity instead of publishers. And this is only for new authors. Now, for somebody like you with four books out, that's a completely different ballgame. You've got a separate set of metrics, which you can take to a publisher to say, I deserve this because here's my books. But for new authors, I think it's huge. It's a chance for people who don't write traditional or don't write in a format that editors easily understand to instantly resonate with an audience. You know, you can look at the biggest thing in the history of books, Harry Potter, rejected 12 times before it was published. You know, people didn't know. There were 12 people who thought, that's not going to sell. It's not that they didn't like it. They thought, that's not going to sell. I'm not going to spend my company's resources on producing that product. So if it's market tested for free and you've got 500 to 750 million people out there as your potential audience, you can gather a lot of data on what resonates based on the end consumer, not the intermediate gatekeeper. And as far as the shrinking hard SF shelf goes, you know, that's every genre goes through ebbs and flows. And largely, I would agree with you that 99% of the books I find in a bookstore, I'm stunned that it got published. And that's, you know, and I think most authors are probably in that camp because we're like, why don't they just publish my book over and over again? It's great. But you know, the thing is that if the audience is shrinking, the audience isn't there for me as a writer. I am there for the audience. So it's up. That's kind of the two polar opposites of writing. There's the philosopher writing where this is important, needs to be said. Let's kick up some dirt. Let's make some people think. Then on the other end, there's let's entertain. And on the entertainment side, your job is to sell books. And most everybody's probably somewhere left or right on that spectrum. But in my world, I'm there to entertain people. It's an audience. If I'm getting bigger numbers and bigger audience, more people buying the book, then I'm doing a better job as a manufacturer of a particular kind of product.
Okay. I would agree that we all have to entertain. You know, publishers won't keep publishing you if your numbers don't work out. If you don't sell, they won't keep publishing you. They won't do it out of love. What I guess I'm objecting to in speaking in terms of market testing, et cetera, is the way in which more and more of what used to be done by the publishing houses gets offloaded on the authors. There was a time when editors used to edit. Now they mainly acquire. They're acquisitions editors. there was a time, perhaps some lost golden age, when publicity and marketing folks really focused on marketing and publicity. Now there's more and more of an expectation that the author flog his or her book on a blog, that the author take up most of the expense of a whole book tour process. That's what I'm really objecting to, and the idea of, you know, the publishers now get to have a proven commodity. Well, maybe do we really need publishers? But that's a whole nother matter, isn't it? What that's service soon, are they yeah. providing? And you know, I guess the box that the thing that gets to me, and this is going to make me very unpopular, and I'll go ahead and say it anyway.
You're already unpopular.
Yeah, I'm already unpopular. The box that the Creative Commons and the freeware folks fail to think outside of is this sort of naively messianic economic libertarian faith in corporate capitalism. Now, I'm well aware that book publishers are corporations, too well aware of it. But that sort of faith that if we just send it out there and we'll be popular, et cetera, that faith downplays or outright dismisses the genuine pain and suffering accompanying economic and social dislocations that come along with technological innovations. People do suffer. I'm just asking you to think about that. Okay. Now, I can be nasty, and of course, you'll see a bunch of my stuff get podcast later this week, because as it turns out, I used to be a DJ many, many years ago. And it turns out that the local NPR affiliate out where I live has been recording a story of mine every year. So it's done. And my web guy pressured me into sending him stuff. So that stuff's going to appear. But for me, I guess print is still the first thing for me. It's plant dye on dead trees. All right. I still am associated with that. The book is a tactile object, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess the larger question is, if people are more and more inclined to read off a screen and we're offering more and more content that is free on the screen, how's it going to kick back for the author? How's the money going to come back?
Let me just put it a little bit here, because it seems to me that we're kind of dancing. There's no conflict here, because not that I'm trying to create any, but, you know, I listen to, like Scott's work. It seems to me like you're, one way or another, you're gonna figure out a way to get it. This is just the way you did it right now. Mm-hmm. I think you know how to write, you know how to tell a story, and you know how to market it. So and I think, you know, you're on the cutting edge of this new technology, but I don't think I don't think it's because of the new technology that you're published or that
Correct.
Cory Doctorow is published. You could also not be published, but it that doesn't seem to me to be the cutting edge. I think the gatekeeper, like you say, the gatekeeper becomes the public mm-hmm. instead of the
public.
Yeah, the gatekeeper becomes the public instead of the editors and the establishment.
Okay.
And what gets missing in that for me is the public has no memory of science fiction and what it is and what it's supposed to be. What the gatekeepers do, when at their best, is it's like Eliot's essay, The Tradition and the Individual Talent. They keep the shelf of books intact, and they sort of keep us in line. And I think and you can certainly make an argument, and I would make it in another menu, that we all ought to be out of line and we ought to be wild and crazy. But on the other hand, I think it's good to have this gravity that closes it up. Otherwise, it becomes too diffuse and too.
Well, you know, and that's the nature of having multiple formats, multiple channels, multiple medias. That's the nature of 500 channels on TV, the internet, getting any kind of entertainment that you want. A lot, you know, to disagree, a great deal of this. Here is your 100 books of required reading that you have to know to be able to understand a larger genre. A lot of that has, you know, been forced upon us in school, et cetera. You need to read this. You need to be here. This is your culture. You have to understand it. Whereas for a lot of us, we're out finding our own and making our own culture. And if we don't want to read something, we don't want to be made to read it. There's just so many choices now. And there's so many voices that can be heard because of the technology. You can just go out there and do whatever you want. But it's a two-way street, too, I think, Howard, because if you want to be messianic with your work, there's no better field than the internet, because you don't have to sell 10 copies. You can write whatever the hell you want. If that caters to 50 people are like, this has changed my life. I know what I want to be now because this has made me think. You couldn't get a publisher to print a book that's going to sell 50 copies. But with a podcast, a blog, free PDFs, you can write exactly the content that you want.
But I still want the social imprimatur of talking not to myself or to a social network community, but to talking to the larger culture. You know, there's a centrifugal and a centripetal force going on here. And it's true, you're absolutely right, that a lot of this is fill the channels. You got to fill all those outlets, all those multiple platforms. Yeah, and they need to be filled. But I really have difficulty with the idea that the web, particularly Web 2.0, is somehow a democratizing influence. I think that's a neoliberal canard. Neoliberalism is neither neo nor liberal, but it's the belief that the economic and social life of a culture or a planet is best managed through corporate market forces. And I don't agree with that. And I think that increasingly what you see on the web, it's corporate, it's there to sell you product. And sure, print was less obviously intended to sell other product. You may remember paperback books with ads for cool cigarettes in the middle of them. But generally, because print itself came out of a largely pre-capitalist world, it grew up in a different culture. The web is almost corporatized from the get-go. And that's, I guess, my difficulty with it. And I think that that's what Terry was talking about, that idea that, that you know, this diffusion. And I'm not saying you have to read every book of the culture.
Just most of them.
No, not even most. But what I tell my students is, it's easy to be a writer. All you have to do is read a lot and write a lot. You need to read a lot to see how other people have used the language. Read carefully, critically, to see how other people have used the language, perhaps in your own genre. And you have to write a lot to develop your own voice. I think you need to have both. The background to see how others have used it, and then your own experience writing it to develop your own way of speaking. And I think if either one of those are lacking, you're lacking something. Now, I know that my books are difficult. You know, if I wanted fame and fortune, I wouldn't write difficult science fiction on obscure scientific topics for small audiences and smaller paychecks, okay? But that is a choice I made. But it's not as far as to go to say, well, I'm just going to write this for my friends. I do believe that one should develop one's craft so that they can speak to as much of the culture as possible. And one of the imprimaturs that you are speaking to the culture is you get paid for it. One of the things I constantly have to remind writers is money should flow toward the writer, not away.
Well, okay? This is what Very Scott's simple. Doing, right?
So. Yeah, you're making money. Good. That's using another channel.
You know, if you can't really always follow the dollar signs, otherwise Britney Spears is the most influential creature we've had in our culture in 200 years.
Yes.
You know, but a lot of what I hear coming from you guys is that the what I want to know is who decides? Who gets to decide what is good
Hartwell.
If it's not the customer? What's that?
Hartwell.
David
right?
Hartwell. That is a scary thought in itself, but we will.
Well,
let
you
that
know,
float
it's
there.
Funny because we could be having it just struck me that we could be having the same conversation in 1952 about paperbacks, about the beginning of science fiction, which was 25 cent. They were products, and they were 25 cent mm-hmm. products that were not sold in bookstores. They were sold on racks and bus stations. They weren't really even considered books.
And how long has it taken for science fiction to be considered literature at all?
In where I teach, it's
sure.
not.
I've
been involved with the Department of the English Department at California State University, Fresno, off and on, when I'm not writing full time, for 17 years. And in that time, the Creative Writing Program, which is a subdivision of the Department of English, has never once asked or allowed me to teach a course in their program. Why? Most recently, the director of the Creative Writing Program said, letting a science fiction writer teach in our program would be like having a rock musician teach in a school of jazz. That's a quote, okay? So believe me, I am not one to lionize the literary establishment, okay? But I do think that it's important that we know what's been produced in our genre, at least have a good sense of that, so we can see what we can mess with. Hemingway said, know the rules so you can break them better. All right, and that's what we try to do. But I say let a million flowers bloom. Let everybody try this. But in my case and in everyone else's case, I do think we ought to consider not only authors' rights, but also authors' responsibilities to other authors.
And you feel that making things open on the internet, giving things away to see how they work, et cetera, you think
giving them away for free. I think for me it poses problems. There's a distinction. Some of you may be aware of the difference between what was known as the free or open source movements and the difference between that and something like Creative Commons. And there's a really wonderful article, which I will now whip out of my handy folder here, called Toward a Standard of Freedom, Creative Commons, and the Free Software Movement. It's a really profound analysis of what is good and what is bad about those movements. Really good piece of work. It's by a gentleman named Benjamin Mako Hill. And it's very interesting and wonderful because it's an article that is in some ways critical of the Creative Commons share-alike license, yet it's issued under the Creative Commons share-alike license, which is great, which I love. And I love this sort of irony and to be able to appreciate that irony. One of my favorite bits of irony in regard to technology is the fact that Theodore Kaczynski, a very well-known anti-technology person, his writing was most often perused via the internet, a system he hated. Okay, history's full of those ironies, and I expect to be tripped up by such ironies. But in asking us to think a little bit outside the boxes and not just go with market forces, et cetera, I'm suggesting that perhaps the ironies won't trip us up so painfully.
Well, at this point, what I'm still waiting to see, and it's this isn't something that's defendable on your end because we haven't had enough time, and you're saying that looking at the long term is what we have to watch out for. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're looking at the primary proponents of giving it away for free and then following up with sales. You know, Banned Books has been doing it for 10 years now. Mm-hmm. You know, Cory Doctorow, My Success.
Charles Strauss.
A couple of people, Matt Wallace,
Eric Flint.
Eric Flint with, 1692.
Yeah. Right.
You know, Matt Wallace, who's a totally unknown author outside of the podcasting sphere, but has had one of his short stories optioned for a movie. Mm-hmm. John Lenihan's another Patio Books guy who's got a hardcover coming out. Nobody knows who this guy is, and it's going to be distributed by Pan Macmillan. None of this would have happened without getting out there mixing up. So, and then the next step of this is if I'm successful, if John's successful, people are going to start looking to authors that are giving it away and developing an audience going, these guys got to get paid. Because we've already seen Lenihan and Sigler and Seth Harwood and Matt Wallace that we have seen that these guys produce revenue for the company. So, you know, going back to, I still don't see the detriment, how it's going to hurt people. There's always an evolution of content. There's always a change in the environment, and there's always certain writing movements that have their peak and then die off and come down to a smaller area while other peaks come up. You know, cyberpunk came up and was very popular. Now it's come down. There's always a cyclical cycle. So is what you're saying that your
cyberpunk was a literary movement, not a methodology of distribution. I guess my objection to that is that there's something called harms of aggregation. You know, one automobile on the entire planet does not cause, or in California, does not cause many problems. But if you've got 30 million of them, they generate problems, harms of aggregation. My concern is precisely if the publishing industry looks to the success of writers who have done well with the free movement, instead of being something that the writers have to fight for with the publishers will begin to demand it. And that, I think, has real problems because that's where we start the downward slide in terms of problems with advances and royalties.
So what you're saying, what you're objecting to is that writers have to bring their audience with them. In other words, these will be the successful writers. So there won't be a writer where the publisher will develop the audience.
Right.
The publisher will just wait until the free agent can come and they can sign. Jacob, what do you think of this?
You're a publisher.
Yeah.
Ooh.
He's a corporate meanie.
Yeah, corporate meanie.
Very meanie. Which part of this precisely? I mean, I think
Jacob.
Microphone.
I think what Howard's talking about is very interesting. But I you know, one of the things that occurs to me is when you have several authors putting their stuff out for free, and gaining an audience, I think that's it's a really terrific thing, and it's a really groundbreaking thing. But what happens when all the other writers emulate that, mm-hmm. and suddenly there are 200,000 books available for free on the web, and you know, and it keeps going up and up and up, you know, then mm-hmm. you know, it becomes this huge sea of
audience
books.
Selection.
Well, but also the books that have not been vetted. How do you know which the good ones are? It brings a whole different climate to. Mm-hmm.
It's a phase change. It's a total phase change in the industry, where we would be going from an area where a company like yours, and you'll still be able to do this, because this is an important book. I like this. We want to put this out. We want to give this a marketing push because people need to know who this author is, because what he or she has to say is very, very important. And then you also have the audience going, this shit rocks. I mean, that's the reaction you're going to get. You're going to get people out there like, you know, pardon my language, but the phrase I've been thinking of lately is when somebody gets done reading a book, goes, fuck yes, that was awesome. You know, that guttural response to the fiction where you get an emotional tangent, like that was important to me. You get both. I don't see where you don't get both things.
Well, I also think there's a difference between podcasting and, say, distributing, you know, copies of things in like PDF or
full text or
Word documents, right? Where you're actually downloading the text. I mean, a podcast is essentially a radio mm-hmm. Piece, and it's usually if you're podcasting a novel, you don't usually. I'm probably a little ignorant about this, but in my experience, we did one of these for a book called Burn that won the Nebula Award last year for James Patrick Kelly. But he podcasted the book, but it was podcast in 16 chapters, one chapter every week. Mm-hmm. You would download, you would go and you listen to the new chapter. It wasn't like you had the book. And then you had, you know, if
you just print it all out at once.
Print it out, and you could read it. You could read it next month. You could come back to it. You could give it to a friend. You know, it's not a podcast. Isn't a tangible book.
That's important because the tangible book, I all this talk about e-paper, PDFs, printing out your own book. The book as a portable object is never, ever, ever going to go away. I mean, it's zero power. It's low cost. It can't be destroyed except for fire by water. And when I put out the PDF for Ancestor, which came out and did real well on Amazon.com, we were all surprised at how well it did. We made a PDF. We gave that PDF away. It was downloaded 42,000 times the week before the book came out. And on every page, we tried to explain to people, like, it costs more to print this than it does to just go buy it. You know, and the cost of printing it may come down, but there's still you're paying for convenience with a book. I mean, if you print it, you have to bind it, you have to carry it around. It's a giant mess, dude. For $15, you can actually have the book and it goes on your shelf. I don't think the print book is going to go away anywhere.
Well, we wouldn't be having this conversation if it wasn't the fact that your books sell because you give them away first. That's what
Correct.
Corey says. That's mm-hmm. what Strauss says, and it does work because people do if they like it, yep. they'll think, oh shit, this is neat. I'm going to get the book. Or I'll get the book and give it to Elizabeth or Jim, you know. Mm-hmm. So people do still want the book. It's true.
And I think when you're giving it away, even if you have the 200,000 books out there, you're still going to get those cultural phenomenons and the cream's going to rise to the top and something that makes you read it where it resonates with you and you want to go out and tell your friends, like, you guys got to read this book. This book is fantastic. It's just more books in the playing field. And the other area that we haven't really discussed yet is that books in a bookstore are one thing. People who go to bookstores, people who go to libraries, people who stop their day and walk into a place of business and get a book and peruse it and check it out, that's one thing. Or hearing about it from somebody else, that's another thing. It's a different ballgame when a digital copy of that book is for free and you're at work and I get an instant message from a friend, click this link, check out this free PDF. I do it. I'm instantly consuming the work that has been spread to me. It's zero time. I don't have to leave where I'm at. I have it instantly and I'm already reading it with the endorsement of a friend. Those are things that were not available 10 years ago. That is a way for your product name, your brand name, your philosophical bent, all of that to spread at the speed of light, carried from one person to another in this giant expanding viral meme that we just didn't have before. I can pass one copy of a book on. 3 months later, they can pass that copy of a book on. In that same 6-month period, my PDF's been downloaded 100,000 times.
Sure. I don't as a publisher, I actually have no problem with this at all, because I think if one of our authors gives their book away for free and people can download it and they can read the first chapter and see if they like the book before they really make a commitment to reading the book, you know, we will sell copies of the book. It'll be in people's interest. They can go and get the book with a really nice cover and put that on their shelves, and you know, when they're done, and you know, and give it to someone else. And as a reader, it bothers me in that, you know, what this process is circumventing is the old process of having to break in through this established.
Have you decided?
Well, not a me deciding, but you know, but that you have to, as a writer, you have to, you know, you have to pay some dues. You write a few books and you sell the third or the fourth, and you know, and you're competing with all these, you know, hundreds of thousands of other books. And I think what's happening now is that there's a real novelty and that there's a few people who are doing what you're doing. And so it's been very easy to get your work in front of a large audience, because there's a large audience there without much competition.
That's going to end.
And that's going to end. And that, as a reader,
Howard Hendricks is podcasting, for example. If nobody knows who I am,
it's all over.
Well, if you go to patiobooks.com, you've never heard of Scott Sigler. Ooh, there's Howard Hendricks. I've heard of him. Where are you going to spend your time reading? Right. So I think you're right. It's going to end.
That leaves two sort of levels. You've got people giving stuff away for free that you have to sort of, you know, and then you have, you know, and that gets you to the next level of competing with the other 100,000 people who actually have books in stores. And so you're eventually what you have is a glut of product.
Well, there's always been a glut of product.
Is 180,000 books published every year or something like that?
But I think something that Terry mentioned is very interesting. The idea that you have to come with, as it were, a pre-created audience. And I think that that's problematic, because what it follows a trend that I think has already been going on in publishing for years. This idea that you need to score big on your first book, the Stephen King, Amy Tan situation. You need to score big. I remember Larry McMurtry, who wrote Lonesome Dove, Last Picture Show, a number of other things, speaking at a Writers Week event in Southern California. And he said that this was in the 80s. And he said, you know, when I began in the 50s, he said, I couldn't survive in today's market. Because when I began in the 50s, he said, publishers would develop a writer's career. They say, yeah, I'll give them a grand or two and keep them going. There's potential here. Now there's this sort of one-hit wonder phenomenon that you have to score big first time. And you can see a parallel to that in the recording industry. Before the advent of the sort of album-oriented and career-oriented rock and roll, if you look at the 50s, it was those little 45s, one hit. You know, sometimes the medium does dictate the message. Then, starting in the 60s, you had this emphasis of building a career, larger format. Now, with MP3s, with file sharing, you're seeing a return to that more sort of 45 one-hit wonder approach to the world. My fear is that we're going to see some of the same things, exacerbating things that are already happening in publishing. That's my concern with it. For those who are benefiting from it, fantastic. You caught that wave early, harness the inevitable, ride that sucker. Okay. But my fear is the long term. You know, what's going to be left when the wave goes out?
Well, in some respects, you know, this isn't true for what Tachyon does, but for other publishers, in some ways, I'm better off publishing Scott Sigler before he's found a publisher than I am publishing Howard Hendricks, because Howard Hendricks has a track record. As a publisher, I can go into this thing called BookScan, which tells me every point of purchase sale that Howard has made. These are sales to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and many of the bigger independent stores. And so, you know, it doesn't give me library sales, it doesn't give me some other stuff, but I can say ballpark, you know, a Howard Hendricks book will sell this much. But also the buyer at Barnes & Noble will look at that when he's making his purchase You'll say, well, we sold this much of the last Howard Hendricks book, but we had 25% returns. Let's order 25% less. Which means, of course, you're still going to get the 25% return, but you'll sell 25% less books. And with an unproven person, there's no detriment. If you put the right marketing campaign behind it, you know, we've seen all these books recently by first-time authors just go through the roof. I forget the author wrote The Historian, which is a historic vampire novel, and we had
Elizabeth Kostova.
Right.
Thank you.
And we had Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, oh, yes. Susanna Clarke's epic historical British fantasy. But those books, you know, didn't have anything holding them back. Mm-hmm. Right. When their publishers said, you know, we're putting this kind of money behind it, and we expect this kind of return, the publishers, you know, the gatekeepers in this case, which are Barnes & Noble and Borders and all the people at the bookstore, said, great, we'll take them.
Are you all familiar with the Robin Hobb, Megan Lindholm situation?
Yeah, sure.
Where basically the book chains, believe me, I have no particular love of huge brick-and-mortar bookstores. They're something I've had to deal with. But one of the things I found very discouraging is that an author had to change her name and publish under a different name because the chains had dictated that the books published earlier under her own name were not selling well enough. She changed her name, and then she had bestsellers. Now, was there a magic sea change that happened there? I don't know. But this is where the marketing emphasis, the bean counting, gets in the way of art and craft. Yes, I will say the evil word, art. Okay? Not just commerce. If you live in a world where everything, all that matters is profit, then there's nothing else of value. If it's completely market driven, there's nothing else of value. The ultimate ideology is profit. I think that's a failure to see human beings as only profit driven or only technological. One of the problems with science fiction is we have had a tendency to think there's a technological solution to every human problem. That's just plain wrong. Human beings are not just technological creatures. They're more than technological creatures. To say that there's a technological solution to every human problem is just plain naive. It is spanking the space monkey, choking the cyber chicken, knuckling the nano knob. And if you want to throw God in there, it's pulling the God pud too.
But to say that the profit-driven perspective conveys that there's no end value is to completely devalue the people who bought the book.
No.
The people who buy the book, who make Stephen King's book a bestseller,
yes,
they have value. Their opinion has value. And I think that most of the points you're making are very interesting, but we have to look at the whole picture of the sales cycle. It's the author, it's the publisher valuing the author, developing the author, but at the end of the day, it's people out there who go to work for $10 an hour, $20 an hour, whatever they're making, and then decide to drop that money down to go buy a book. That is the end value of this whole chain. Otherwise, you're an artist creating art for your own sake, for the sake of the art, because it's important, it needs to be said, or are you an entertainer who's out to entertain people and sell product? I think there's a very definitive difference between those two things.
I don't know. I think that's a false dichotomy because on both of your parts, and I think we're kind of barking up the wrong tree. It seems to me like the problem with publishing, which is kind of what we're talking about, is not people giving away books. It's not all that kind of stuff. It's exactly what Jacob said. Publishing, I used to work in publishing. It is the most old-fashioned industry in the U.S., and they just now started computerizing their sales, and it killed the mid-list because... And so now they no longer have to, Tom Doherty no longer has to publish me, you know, because he knows, okay? And that's the way it works. And so it's just the fact that they caught up with the rest of the world and track their inventory instead of 8 months in the future. They track it like a week in the future. You know,
the problem is that as readers, it ruins – the kind of careers that writers have, in that if a writer changes their name four times before they're successful, well, maybe the writer is still successful, but it's very hard for us to figure out what their career path is.
But that was her choice.
Well, no. Like, what
the person who changed her name, that was her choice.
Sure. But take someone like Ross MacDonald, who's one of the most popular writers ever. Ross MacDonald's first critical success, or not critical success, his first commercial success was with his 12th book. But his publisher, Knopf, kept all of his books in print so that when the 12th book hit big, the other 11 books were still available, and all of those sold, and he eventually wrote, 40 Lou Archer books, and every one of them was a tremendous success, and all of them were always in print. There was a point where he was not successful, and for him to, if he had written, under several different names, there would be 8 or 9 books now that most of us would not be familiar with. And I think these are sort of
like the Richard Bachman books, which get republished.
Well, that's a little different. It's sort of like the books that Doris Lessing wrote under another name, just to see if someone actually would buy the books.
Maybe we should throw this open. Does anybody have
a question?
Anybody but you?
It is a false dichotomy. By the way, you're right. Art and commerce.
Go
that
ahead.
Is
Terry, you alluded to something that I think could be expanded on here. I'm old enough to remember when a science fiction paperback cost 25 cents, a trade paperback cost $4.50, a hardcover cost $7. Now a hardcover is $27, trade paperback's $15, a paperback is $7.99. And I'm going to admit it, I own several books by Howard Hendricks, and Howard Hendricks has never seen a penny of the money I spent on them because I will never pay list for any book. They're way online, and the authors are getting paid not a whole lot more than they got in the 50s.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. The rest of it goes to the corporation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This bites.
Oh, it does.
And I don't know what the answer to this is.
There's a little history you might want to look at. The fact that if you look at book publishing, say, prior 1980, there were a lot more independent book publishers who were not part of major media conglomerates. A 5% return was pretty good. If you had 5% growth, you're doing well. But the big corporations bought them out and said, no, we need a 15 to 20% growth rate. That tended to drive things toward huge, very large, big splash, big hit approaches. And another thing that contributed to the proverbial death of the mid-list. Okay, look at the history. Look at media consolidation over the last 30 years. And I think that also contributed to it.
And one of the aspects that we haven't talked about at all tonight is advertising. There's two forms of entertainment called TV and radio, which have done pretty well for themselves by giving away product and selling advertising against the downloads or the consumption of that product. So getting back to, the mid-list is going to be people who are... And the environment has changed. This is evolution. Things aren't the same. The atmosphere has changed. The oxygen content is not what it was 2 billion years ago. And now it's time for a different creature to step up that can succeed in that environment and take advantage of it. And that new environment is self-promotion, engaging with your listeners and interacting with your listeners. Now, if you're a mid-list author, let's say my book comes out April 1st. It's a flop. I sell 5,000 copies, that's great. But I'm able to capture information on, say, half of those people, 75% of those people. I'm now able to start building my own database as my own company. I'm a mid-list author unto myself. POD, podcast, PDS with ads in it, online books like Van puts up with ads in it. There's a whole different revenue stream available to the author via ads and via donations. What Patio Books is finding, what some people have put out small press books with Patio Books, is they have made more via just donations from people going, if this is free, if you enjoy it, throw some money the author's way. If you don't, that's fine. They're making more off of donations than they ever made off of the actual sale of the book. Now, that's not the same as mid-list, because mid-list authors can make a living just doing that. Donations can't do that right now. But as we expand the numbers, we're finding additional revenue streams for an author that they can bring in money that goes directly to them. Not if you buy it in a used store or you buy it at discount or Howard gets his 10% off of something he spends 2 years on and the corporation pockets a profit margin of 20 or 30, which isn't right at all. So there's the technology taketh and it giveth as well. There's certain areas that you can, as an author, you can use to bring money in directly to yourself without somebody else dipping into the pie.
And which does have an appeal to me, as long as it doesn't screw other authors. That's my only concern. I think it's faulty, though, to say that, to make the analogy of evolution. That presumes that evolution is itself is progressive, is teleological, has some goal, gets better and better. Evolution, according to Darwin, doesn't guarantee that things get better. They just get different.
That's no, all I'm saying. I'm saying things are different. That's I'm not right. saying things are better at all. Okay. In a perfect world, the corporations take a young author under their wing, give them four or five books, support them, just like the old days of the band. Like you said, in the 70s, it was a whole different ballgame. Now, if you're going to make it in music, your ass has to be out there in a van, on tour, developing your own audience, being Dave Matthews, being able to go to RCA and say, hey, we sold 30,000 copies of our CD, pay us. It's just, you know, it's not better. It's the way it is.
All right. Well,
anybody, what?
I feel like,
this is the most inviting operative I had to ask a question. There's been a lot of things touched on here, and I think great conversation on either side of the argument. It's pretty obvious.
It's a two-sided argument. It's sort of a circle.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would definitely agree with that. But I think Howard brought something up, and I want to discuss it for just a minute and get the opinion of both panelists here. And Terry, you're welcome to chime in as well. And that has to do with the blockbuster mentality. Right, the blockbuster mentality, if you don't understand what I'm talking about here, is that a small percentage of authors, movie producers, record producers, whoever it is, they make the big bucks. And the rest of the folks live in that mid-list or even lower-list attitude. And that's been the way that it is for a variety of reasons. And my question is, you know, I got to make a statement first. You know, when I started Podiobooks.com, unlike Scott, who had a very definite a plan of action about making true money with his, we just did it for fun. Everybody involved with it already had day jobs, and we just thought this is an interesting idea to help facilitate this. We're now looking at it as possibly the way we can actually make some money, but it wasn't the initial idea. But back to that idea, if there is, as Howard has mentioned here, this I'll use your word, this harm to the rest of the authors out there, to where it's not they have to work harder, they have to do things differently or whatever the case it is to be as good as, let's say, a Scott Sigler, who is the current rock star in giving his podcast away for free. He is the current blockbuster. I think sometime in the next unit of time, whether that's 1 month, 1 year, 1 decade from now, blockbusters go away. What happens in that world, and is that a world either of you guys want to live in?
I'll just jump on this first. I think it's a sliding scale based on the numbers of the audience that's available. If there's anywhere from 500,000 to 750 million people online right now, that number is going to expand exponentially till we probably get to the 2 billion mark in the next 10 years or so. So what a blockbuster is to me now, having 30,000 people listen to my novel, may be average in 3 to 5 years. A blockbuster in 3 to 5 years may be, if you don't have 1 million people listening to your book or downloading your PDF, you're not, quote-unquote, a blockbuster. So as to what's going to happen, 10 years from now, if you have 30,000 people listening to your book and you're able to sell ads against that audience, you're still going to be doing just fine. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I agree the whole concept of a blockbuster is going to go away because there's so many smaller blockbusters, because with that many people, if you're able to put your work out and it's good quality work, the audience is going to find you if you help them figure out where you're at.
So a shift from, you're speaking of a shift from mass marketing to niche marketing.
Right.
In essence.
Yeah.
This is a double-edged sword. To some degree, the blockbuster has helped to float, make corporations that are successful enough doing it to support other writers who are not blockbusters. So there's been that small appropriate thing. My objection is that people are not looking long-term at it, that it's, we're just going to make the money now, want it now, want it now, want it now. That's my real difficulty. Will there be a shift? Yeah, I think the shift is already underway. And to me, there's something wonderful about that and something disheartening, because the signal-to-noise ratio is going to change. It's going to be harder, I think, to speak to a larger part of the culture if everything's just divided up this way. And I don't know whether the mass marketing, the niche marketing thing is actually going to happen. There have been so many things that have been proffered to us, the idea of the paperless office. the idea of dematerialization of production, the weightless information society. I haven't seen any of that stuff happen. And I really do think that the idea that we're going to shift from mass marketing to niche marketing is probably still fallacious, especially if it's still largely based on popularity, word of mouth. What you're going to see is big hits that last a shorter amount of time. Big hit, shorter amount of time. That not careers, but big hit, make your money, get out now. You know, who will remember Britney Spears in 5 years? Some will, but not that many. That's what I'm looking at, the one-hit wonder phenomenon. Not that blockbusters are going to disappear, but they're going to be more ephemeral, more evanescent, is basically my point on it.
Yeah. Well, I would just say, the thing I think of that, I sort of, you know, I don't disagree with much that Scott is saying. I think, I do think it's, I don't think commerce is big.
You have to live with it.
Yeah, I think
you have to live.
But I do disagree. It's like there's this idea that you have, if you get rid of the gatekeepers and people appeal directly to the mass audience, and then you're going to have authors that are going to come with it, they're going to bring their own audience, and this is going to open up to where enormous kinds of creativity that gatekeepers and stuff didn't recognize. So anything that people come up with will, you know, you'll get an enormous burst of diversity and creativity. I think it's very possible it's going to be the opposite. If you really want to do a block, what people really want is the same old thing. And so if you really want the ones that are really going to go, it's going to be the Harry Potters. You know, you got your wizards, you got your broomsticks, you know. And so it's going to be kind of the same. I can see where really unique stuff could flourish in that atmosphere, but I could also see where the main thing would flourish would be the Britney Spears, would be the you know, like you say, the flash in the pan, hugely popular for a little while, and we get you in there, and you know, but who knows?
And at the end of the day, thank goodness that we are in a country and a culture where if you don't like the way the publishing industry works, there's nothing to stop you from going and starting your own imprint and being able to do exactly what you want to do. And then if you're able to go out and either A, make a profit off that, or use your own resources to fund turning other people into long-term support mid-list to move them up to the bestseller list, that's great. That's all wide open. You know, I mean, so if people, it's like when I have political arguments, 9 times out of 10 my argument is, if you don't like it, why aren't you running for office? Why aren't you trying to do something? There's a lot of things you can do. You can go start your own firm and do your own thing.
All right. Well, I think we succeeded. Right, he's decided to speak.
I think Britney Spears is actually the wrong comparison to make. You know, her appeal was to a teenage audience, and then so it's a very much a flash in the pan type of nature.
That's true.
In books, the real blockbusters tend to last for a very long time, and they sell. The blockbuster tends to sell maybe 10 times as much as the next person down. Stephen King in horror, you know, J.K. Rowling in young adult, Tom Clancy in military fiction. For science fiction, I would say actually the big blockbuster is Michael Crichton. You know, how many books did Jurassic Park sell compared to any other science fiction?
More than all of them.
Right. Did that count as a genuine science fiction book?
Yeah, but it's not marketed that way.
No.
Yeah.
But
that's what I'm looking at right now with Crown. They don't want to market me as horror or science fiction. They're like, we're gonna up-level that. I'm like, dude, it's a freaking horror novel. What do you want? So.
Yeah. Well,
so if you're looking for, if you're trying to develop a market for a good, promising young author to be the next blockbuster. You know, there's so many market forces involved. How do you know who's going to be the next Tom Clancy or Stephen King?
You don't know.
Or Cole Mountain or Amy Tan. So they've, you know, so I have a relative, actually, a young woman who's like 21 years old. Not a relative, but a friend of a relative. And she's got a $100,000 advance on her second novel. But if it doesn't sell, she's finished.
Done. Yeah,
she's done. You know. So, but I'm with Scott. That's show business. You know. I don't feel sorry for anybody except myself.
It's never been a nice. I mean, this has never been a nice industry.
No.
there is a lot. You know. I mean, people can there's a general attitude that big business is kind of evil, going for the profit margin. But somebody has to pay the people to lay out that book, edit that book, print that book. Somebody has to get paid to distribute that book. That book is in stores. The people in the stores have to make a wage. The people have to make a profit. The investors have to make a profit. There is money dipping into the till at every phase of the process. And if the product doesn't return a profit to the investors, then it is their obligation to go out and find something that does return, or they go out of business. That's just flat Darwinism down the line. You know what I mean? It is what it is. And I think that the odd part about all this is now, thanks to the internet and podcasts and PDFs, if you just want to create what you want to create, you can do that. If it resonates and you make a profit off that, great. If it doesn't resonate, you still keep putting that out there. And now the difference is, 50 years ago, if you wanted to put something out that only appealed to 500 or 1,000 people, you're gone. No one's going to publish your book. No one gets to hear your voice. Now it's completely different. If you got 1,000 people reading your blog because you got a great voice, that can go on for as long as you live, because there's technology is enabling people at all different levels throughout this process.
One other thing I'd like to point out is, I don't know if you've read Cory Doctorow's article in the latest Woke Up. And
we don't read his shit.
He gives his crap away. I don't like him.
Well, one of the things he mentioned was that there was a study made a few years ago about the effects of online distribution to music sales.
Yeah.
And basically, what it was the bottom 25% actually increased physical sales of CDs. And then from 25 to 98%, it basically had no effect. And the top 2% was where it went down. And
yeah, I remember that.
In terms of books, I think if you're a novelist, you're probably better off. If you're a short story author, like Harlan Ellison, for instance, you're probably on the downside. Because a short story, it's easy to consume.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's what he specializes in.
Yeah.
But if you're a novelist, then at a certain point, you know, it just gets easier to read if you actually have a physical book than if you're trying to, you know, read it off of the screen.
Absolutely.
Or listen to a weekly podcast. And then so in there, the numbers are probably more in your favor.
Yeah. I don't have the same sort of technological optimism that some folks do. Technologies always have unintended consequences as well. And I think it is important and incumbent upon us to consider those possibilities. And that's why I don't see this as a sort of panacea. I don't see it as incredibly evil either, but I think that it's something that should be looked at carefully, as we look at all technologies carefully, instead of just being cheerleaders for what appears on the internet, that we think critically about it. And that's all I'm trying to do.
Well, at that, let's say goodnight.
All right.
Good
thank
night.
You both.
Good
and
night.
We all agree we should look at technology, but I agree with Scott, we can't do a goddamn thing about it.
Oh, I disagree. Technology is neither autonomous nor totalizing. Neither of those. You can do something about it.
Hey, thank you both. Thank you.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.